the mentalities of people, the followers of Islam, are not the source of religion. Whatever Muslims believe, it is in their own mind. It might be affected by different local cultural elements. Quran has a clear source that is the verses of the Holy Quran. People might hold different beliefs about the Day of Judgment. That does not mean these are all sanctioned by Islam or whatever. It's only the verses of the Holy Quran that we can attribute to the religion of Islam. This is a very sensitive issue because some Orientalists, I don't know, some researchers, they have the habit of attributing the mentalities of Muslim to Islam, which is wrong. And it is the verses of the Holy Quran. Yes, there are different understandings, sometimes different interpretations about the Mutashabahat verse. But there are clear verses that they have solid meaning. And even in the side of Mutashabahat, ambiguous verses that they had historically different being understood by Muslims, even that has a context, has a theological discussion. So it's always safer to refer to the verses of the Holy Quran to understand what does Islam say about humanity, about the destiny of humanity, about what happens at the end, or what's the goal, what's the whole point about all these pains and pleasure, this history filled with different ups and downs. What's the point about all of this? Now, when we refer to the Holy Quran, we realize that, yes, there's the concept of the Day of Judgment. There's a greater divine plan in bringing about justice and in bringing about different qualities in the human beings. Now, we said that in order to understand the correctness of these beliefs and the effect that they have on us as human beings, on our behaviors, we should check the behavior of people. Quran said, for example, if you see humility in the practices, in the behavior of a person, then you should know that this is a correct sign. This is a sign of a correct belief. If you see arrogance, then no, this is the sign of incorrect belief. Now, another way to understand or to get accurate understanding of a Quranic picture of this whole grand design of human beings, that is the Day of Judgment, is to read some of the verses pertaining to certain phases of the Day of Judgment. Now, I will explain this later after the break, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We said in order to understand the accurate picture that Quran has to offer us, whether we want to accept it or reject it, first we should understand the picture and do not just feel sufficient when we ask here that person and that person. No, we go to the Holy Quran and we see that Quran explains and introduces certain phases for the Day of Judgment. That is known in Islamic theology as Mawaqif al-Qiyamah. Mawaqif means phases of the Day of Judgment. Now, there are discussions about this and verses about, like, for example, the length of Yawm al-Qiyamah, how long will it take, and each of these mawaqif, each of these phases, for example, there is the phase of Sarat. Sarat means the bridge over hellfire. There is the mawqif of Tatayur al-Kutub, when the book of deeds are given to people. Everything that people have done have been recorded, and each individual, they have a book, and they will receive a kulla insanan alzamnahu ta'irahu fi unuqi. Every single human being, we have attached to his neck the book of the deeds that he has done. in the life of his in his material life on dunya. And we have the weighting, the scale, the mizan, the concept of somehow weighting deeds and the acts of people based on some yardstick that is there. And then there is the famous discussions about hell, hellfire and paradise that also is on other religions, and what's the nature of these. And then there is the concept of the middle position, al-a'raf, somewhere not is in hell, not is in paradise, what happens to people. So Quran has verses about all of this, and understanding them, they have close connection to our behavior here, to our understanding of even moral questions, moral dilemmas that we have. For example, the concept of sirat, the way, the path, that is very tiny, that is sharper than the sword and tinier than a thread of hair. Well, some people believe what we're going to see on the Day of Judgment is the manifestation of the situations that we have in this world. We're going to have a discussion over that. This is related to the discussions of morality, to discussions of details that will change situations in the ethical situations. So these are all called mawaqif al-qiyamah, or the stages of human destiny. And as I said, there are not many scholars, many of the experts in the exegesis of the Holy Quran. They believe these are these are going to be manifestations of what we do here. And those who could see, according even to the verses of the Holy Quran, كَلَّا لَوْ تَعْلَمُونَ عِلْمَ الْيَقِينَ لَتَرَوُنَّ الْجَحِيمِ, if you had certainty, you would see these by your own eyes. So these are not something that is going to take place. These are some parts of our reality. For example, the scale, the yardstick of our behavior. For example, we have a moral act. And this moral act, there is a set, there is a scale of 1 to 10. Of how much this moral act was good, how much this is going to be rated. So is there such a thing as like having different rates of different moral acts? Yes, there is, according to the verses of the Holy Quran. And we can find some verses. Inshallah, we're going to have the discussion of these in the following episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Economic divide.
The U.S. is still grappling on how to deal with China. It has imposed tariffs to slow down its economy and to bring back manufacturing to the U.S., but has failed to materialize. Instead of following its own advice, which is to work with the Chinese and see competition as a positive thing, it is doing its best to prevent China from advancing, especially economically. The U.S. has just missed out on a chunk of soybean sales to China that would have brought in billions of dollars to American manufacturers. Add to that, other sectors which are suffering and getting crushed by U.S. tariffs to China, the U.S. economy, and its consumers are hurting more than ever before. Coming up in today's program, U.S. manufacturers hurting. Trump's tariffs are hurting American manufacturers and workers. Trump is not offering a real strategy to create jobs and for the economy to grow. Just continuous chaos. U.S. agriculture consumers suffering. Chinese crushers are buying Brazilian beans amid U.S.-China trade war, with the Chicago soybean futures near five-year lows amid trade uncertainty. China dumps the dollar. In the midst of it all, China is ditching the dollar fast, with China's leaders thinking a globally accepted yuan can insulate their exporters from movements in the dollar's value. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Dr. Yang Jing, Assistant Director and Research Fellow of the Guang Institute of the GBA, and also Diane Serm, political analyst and former independent candidate for U.S. Senate.
Thank you for inviting me in this program. The trade war has no real rumors. So historically, the U.S. and China have maintained very strong ties in trade, especially in the agricultural products. The U.S. has advanced agriculture technology and large-scale production capabilities, while China has a massive market demand. Nearly 60% of U.S. soybean production used to be exported to China. Even during the periods of tensions in the U.S.-China relations, the agriculture trade had often remained relatively stable. After Trump applied extreme pressures on China, his irrational countermeasures for Chinese government to adjust its soybean import structure and shift to Brazil. The goal is to push the U.S. side to reconsider its policies. So at the core, the U.S. agricultural states, their people, and even the state governments themselves don't want a tariff war, and China doesn't want it either. It's really only the Trump administration that pushing for a tariff or a trade. When U.S. soybean export struggle, the agriculture business might pass on the cost by raising the domestic price, which ultimately hurt its consumers. And the government could also roll out a massive subsidies to the farm states, but that's funded by the taxpayer also, who are also the consumers. So in the end, the people in the United States don't benefit from the trade wars. Only a few American politicians gain their personal advantages.
U.S. farmers are missing out on billions of dollars of soybean sales to China halfway through their prime marketing season. Chinese importers have booked around 7.4 million metric tons of mainly South American soybeans for October shipment, covering 95% of China's projected demand for the month and 1 million tons of for November, or about 15% of expected imports.
The decolonization process decelerated during Trump's era. It's not just China doing this, many countries are actually involved in it. But is China really ditching the dollar rapidly? From what I see now, there is not sufficient evidence for that yet. Different countries approach de-dollarization in their own ways. For example, countries like Russia or other countries hit by the Western sanctions tend to move faster, but their options are limited due to those sanctions. China, on the other hand, is taking a proactive, systematic approach. especially by boosting the RMB international status. And then there are also some pragmatic countries like India, Turkey, which handle it flexibility, say that by promoting the local currency, the settlements in a bilateral or regional trade. The Trump negative impact on the dollars comes down to three main things. First, overusing the dollar as a sanction tool, which forced the other countries to build alternative systems faster. And second, reducing the dollar role in international trade through the trade wars, which weakened its foundation as a global currency. And third, eroding the US international credibility, which shakes the dollar's relevance. However, at this stage, the dollar still has a lot of resilience as a global currency. That's because the US sophisticated financial infrastructure and its economic and technological strength, and the fact that no other currency is fully ready to challenge it yet.
This is the social section of the program. Trump's tariffs have created a drop in sales of various agricultural exports, including soybeans. Data shows the U.S. is losing out on billions of dollars in purchases from China.
Add to that President Trump's tariffs, which have created a drop in sales of various U.S. agricultural exports, including soybeans. Data from the American Soybean Association shows the U.S. is losing out on billions of dollars in purchases from China, which spent over $3 billion on soybeans in the second quarter of 2024. So far has spent $0 this year.
Feels crazy that this needs to be said, but here we are. You need raw materials and equipment to make things. Tariffs on aluminum, steel and machinery raise costs for U.S. manufacturers and make them less competitive. This is economic self-sabotage. Breaking, China has dumped half of their U.S. Treasury bonds since 2012. De-dollarization is accelerating. And while the media distracts you, the financial ground is shifting. China just dumped U.S. Treasuries to 2008 levels. Congress banned CBDCs. Trump is pushing Powell out and putting the dollar on the blockchain with a U.S.-backed stablecoin. Now, while on the dollar, this from the Economist article, China is ditching the dollar fast. To be clear, China is nowhere close to replacing the dollar as a reserve currency, and won't be anytime soon. What it is doing, though, is slowly eroding the dollar's influence by building pipes around America's post-Second World War dominant role in the global system.
These tariff wars are definitely hurting the American consumers and the soybean producers. You may be aware that the U.S. soybean farmers actually wrote a letter to President Trump telling him that they have sold zero soybeans to China this season. China used to be one of our biggest, if not biggest, consumers of American exported soybeans. So that is quite devastating to those farmers, and there are other areas as well. There is such a thing as an actual protective tariff, but it requires having the industry that you're trying to protect. They're not supposed to be punitive like sanctions against other nations, so it's a very short-sighted policy.
China isn't just first to dump the dollar, it's the opening shot in a global exodus. Since Trump swaggered into office, the dollar has been sliding downhill, and now it's tanked harder than any point since 1973. That's not his strength. That's the world's reserve currency being gutted on his watch.
I don't think that the whole world is going to leave the dollar or the majority, but nations, particularly of the global south, particularly those that we have applied tariffs and sanctions to, are choosing to have the flexibility to be able to have trade without the dollar because the dollar has been weaponized. The new development bank of the BRICS still very much relies on the dollar, whereas they just had this incredible meeting in Tianjin, China, of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where they proposed the development bank, which will not rely on the U.S. dollar. As an American, I have to say that I think a better option would be for the United States to stop behaving as an imperial overlord and look for ways to collaborate in a friendly fashion with those nations where they are growing very rapidly, eradicating poverty, and have a bright outlook for the future as opposed to the direction that we're currently heading. Using the dollar as a weapon is not helping the United States, and other nations are finding ways to get around it and to trade in their own national currencies.
This is the InfoNews section of the program, France's economy. Fitch hits France with record low credit score. The agency linked the cut to growing political instability. The EU's second largest economy has one of the bloc's highest debt levels after Greece and Italy, at about 113% of the GDP. Its deficit is projected at 5.4 to 5.8% this year, well above the EU's 3% limit. U.S. arms sales to Israel. As U.S. hurdles toward government shutdown, White House urges $6 billion in new arms sales to Israel. The request to Congress includes $3.8 billion for 30 Boeing AH-64 Apache helicopter gunships, $1.9 billion for 3,250 infantry assault vehicles, and $750 million more for parts and power supplies. Our special investigation into this request comes as the U.S. government balances are on the brink of insolvency after Senate Republicans and Democrats blocked each other's rival plans to borrow more money to keep the lights on. Iran's a snapback. Iran says Europe ignored a logical offer based on baseless excuses. A day after Macron accused Araghchi of lacking agency, the E3 caved in to U.S. pressure and officially began a snapback of U.N. sanctions. Our special investigation reveals that these sanctions would have no major impact on the Iranian economy, especially since it does not involve its banking sector. Iran is already among the most sanctioned countries in the world. UK-US tech deal. The UK's £31 billion tech deal with the US might sound great, but the government has to answer these questions. In the US itself, data center developments have led to rising energy bills, to disrupted water supplies, while supporting remarkably few jobs. This is the in-depth section of the program. China is taking over the reins from the U.S. It has advanced economically, technologically, militarily. At the same time, Trump's tariffs war with China is hurting U.S. farmers, where they have suffered from record soybean exports to China, further exacerbating their dwindling sales. U.S. imports from China crashed to their lowest point in 19 years, dropping to just $64.8 billion. Exports to China also tanked, falling nearly 30%, as overall trade between the two giants shrank dramatically. The U.S. trade deficit with China got smaller, but only because the total trading relationship is collapsing fast. For decades, this partnership fueled globalization. U.S. manufacturing has contracted for a sixth straight month in August as factories dealt with the fallout from the Trump administration's import tariffs, with some manufacturers describing the current business environment as much worse than the Great Recession. Now, let's bring in Dr. Yang Jing, Assistant Director and Research Fellow of the Guangzhou Institute of the GBA. Doctor, my question, there is a theory that if over 100 nations agree that if they simultaneously dump the U.S. dollar and end the petrodollar system, which has kept America's counterfeit empire for 50 years alive, this will crash the U.S. economy. Is this a theory or no, it can be a real possibility?
This is a really intriguing question. If over 100 countries decided to dump the U.S. dollar simultaneously, it would mean that the dollar system had hit some kind of the disruptive event, and the international community was determined to abandon the system they have relied on for decades. But Trump's actions have certainly damaged the U.S. dollar status, but not to the point of an outright collapse. There is an old Chinese saying, it takes a century to build, but only a moment to destroy it. But Trump has shown us that the dollar system might be more fragile than we once thought. But we also need to ask, are there other countries or currencies ready to step in as alternatives? For those participating countries, dumping the US dollar could trigger wild fluctuations in their own currencies, higher trade settlements cost, and reduce the efficiency in the global trade. Does that really serve their interest? And on a global scale, a massive sell-off could spark a new financial crisis with volatile commodity price affecting the energy and the food security worldwide. And in addition, while Trump administration isn't a great at contributing to a global governance, is pretty effective as a disruptors. So is the international community prepared for that? So personally, I think the safest path right now is a gradual systematic push towards the currency diversification.
Turns out Trump is losing the trade war versus the Chinese. One of the signs is the trade deficit. The U.S. trade deficit was 47% larger in first 6 months of 2025 as compared to 2024. We can see from the first 5 months of Trump's second term that the trade gap has widened significantly. The U.S. manufacturing levels shrank for the sixth consecutive month. China's annual manufacturing value added is now over 60% larger than that of the U.S. This was driven by a pullback in production that shows manufacturing remains bogged down, according to the Institute for Supply Management's Manufacturing Index. More proof that Trump has zero clue in what he is doing is seen here. Chinese purchases of American oil are down 90% year on year, while Chinese purchases of Canadian oil are up 700% year on year. What's the impact on the U.S. economy? $20 billion annual loss for the United States at $60 per barrel. Now, let's bring in our other guest, Diane Sir, political analyst. Diane, there is this theory that if over 100 nations simultaneously dump the U.S. dollar and end the petrodollar system, which has kept America's empire alive for the past 50 years, this will crash the U.S. economy. Your thoughts on that?
I think that this scenario is not going to occur, and I will use a different example, which is a battle in which I have been very interested to get the United Nations to invoke the Resolution 377A, Uniting for Peace, to see if one can overcome the veto of the U.S. in the Security Council to do something to stop the mass murderous policy of Israel in Gaza. And what unfortunately seems to be the case is some nations which deplore the policy are still too afraid of jeopardizing their relationship with the United States. Therefore, I think that you're not going to get a bloc of nations to do such a thing, and I think it's very urgent that those of us in the United States have a big responsibility to change the policy of our nation so that we can have decent relationships with other nations, again, particularly the global South. We have to change our policy. It is not helping us. It is hurting the world, and many people are suffering as a result of this policy. But unfortunately, I don't think other nations feel that they are in a position to trash the dollar in this way. So we have to come up with something more collaborative, and it requires a great change in the direction of the United States.
The Chinese economy has not only pulled ahead of the U.S., any effort to bring U.S. manufacturing back home, which has happened, will ultimately fail, since many of its primary products used in manufacturing need to be imported, and the number one destination is China. Meanwhile, China is moving fast to dump the dollar, as evidence in how it has replaced the dollar with the yuan in over 50% of its trade. I'm Kyarash Purnamati, and I'll see you next week.
که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to RIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad. I'm the host of this show. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, that is very influential, and we can learn many lessons from that. One of the things that Imam Khomeini said is that arrogance and negligence will destroy the human being. We have to be really careful that we are not too proud of ourselves, that we are not the victims of arrogance. We shouldn't think that since we are Muslims, we are better than anyone else. We shouldn't think that we are better than other Muslims because, I don't know, like you pray or you do the wajibat, you probably avoid sins. You should never judge people, firstly. And secondly, you should not think that you are better than others. The Quran says, when it talks about the shaitan, about Satan, Allah says, وَلَا يَغُرَّنَّكُمْ بِاللَّهِ الْغُرُورِ. It means be careful that you are not deceived by Satan, thinking that since you are a good person, then it's done. You know, it's like, that's it. You don't need to worry about anything else. That's not how it works. As a matter of fact, you have to be really, really careful that as a Muslim, you have khushu and khudur. You are humble. You have humility.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi. Salli ala Rasul Allah. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
You always think that you are lower than others, even if you're actually higher than them. Okay, you have to be down to earth, especially with regard to Allah and His servants. You should never think that since you have Allah, since you are a Muslim, you have everything and you have nothing to worry about. That's not true. You have to always have this fear that what if Allah is not pleased with me? What if I'm on the wrong path? What if what I'm doing is not something that Allah wants from me? Okay? So you should keep on questioning yourself. And at the same time, you have to be hopeful of the future. You have to be hopeful in Allah's mercy. Okay? So, but you should never become arrogant because it will destroy you. Even the best Muslims, the best scholars, the best pious servants of Allah could become the most wretched human beings on earth if they become arrogant, if they feel that they are better than others.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
There Was a Spring of Truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Have a very good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. In 10th century Cordoba, an Umayyad Islamic dynasty city in Spain with over 70 libraries, the palace library alone had over 60,000 volumes, all written by hand. At the time, the best Latin library in Europe had only 600 parchment books. While the Chinese invested paper sometime before the 2nd century BC, Muslims were the first to mass-produce paper on an intercontinental scale, developing a culture dependent on its abundance. As the price of paper dropped, literacy rose and booksellers and libraries became integral parts of every Muslim city. Like Judaism and Christianity, Islam originated in the Middle East. And here's what's lined up for you in the upcoming hour on Iran Radio this Monday. First, we have a fresh segment of radio productions. We hope these diverse and engaging pieces have provided you with the enjoyment and insight throughout our broadcast. As we continue the broadcast, we return to the profound wisdom of Nahjul Balagha with the Gate of Knowledge, hosted by Sheikh Mustafa Mukhtar. This program is dedicated to explaining the illustrating the profound moral, ethical, spiritual, and social teachings in the Nahjul Balagha, timeless messages for all of us. After this, we take another journey around the world with reporters. Our correspondents will bring you more fascinating reports on a variety of subjects from their regions. Coming up, it's time for another segment of our productions here on Iran Radio. Stay tuned.
Nawf Abdurrabbu al-Zanin is angry with the complicity of her Arab neighbors, who have not only been silent as the Palestinians face being erased. Many of these countries support the Zionist entity in one way or another. Many others in Gaza have expressed the same sentiment. Have the Palestinians truly awakened to the reality that the majority of the Arab nations have no interest in the principles of justice or the concept of the Ummah and just care about themselves? Welcome to Women of Resistance, where on this edition we are bringing you the story of Nawf.
There are Palestinian eyes that have seen history in the making, lips that have cried out for justice longer than most of us have been alive. These Palestinians have borne witness to some of the most powerful moments in their history, and God willing, will continue through their very existence to give voice to Palestine and her story. From the 1967 war to the current genocide, Israeli crimes have been personally witnessed by individuals who continue to share their journeys. This new phase in Palestinian history has brought the past into sharp focus. The Western-backed Israeli genocide has brought upheaval, confusion, and chaos to Nuf and her family. The additional complications of having to juggle the worries of immediate safety to remaining at the bedside of a sick daughter made the situation even more intense. The issue of a permanent displacement often comes up for Palestinians like Nuf. When you're actively being bombed, the thought of seeking shelter elsewhere is a real concern. But in the end, the ties to the land override the temporary hardships. Gaza's very topography has been altered. So have the very psyche of the people because of the unrelenting sea of difficulties brought on by the genocide. History will, rightly, not be kind to this crop of regional leaders for their lack of support for their Palestinian brothers and sisters. The strength and resilience of the Palestinian woman has been a thing of wonder, but Palestinians are exhausted. They need the violence to end. Nuf is issuing a global rallying call. Help end this genocide and save the children. The ones who bear the highest price, the injured, the hungry, those left without an education, or worse. For this Palestinian elder who should have been looking forward to her golden years, Nuf now passes time in physical discomfort, psychological torment, dedicating herself to those who rely on her mothering spirit and abilities. Israeli forces would be happy for this stalwart of Palestine to never know another moment's peace as they continue their campaign of eradication. Don't let them have their way.
Joining me in the studio today to shed further light on the plight of Palestinians is British Palestinian activist and advocate Lubna Speitan. Welcome, Sister Lubna. Very difficult to hear the story of Nuf, just like, you know, we've been listening to different women in Palestine. Why is it so important, Lubna, for us to hear the story of Palestine from Palestinians like you and Nuf?
I feel for years, decades even, our voices have been silenced, and there's been widespread attempts to continue, and now we're seeing, over especially the last 2 years, the increase of state repression. And vitally, and what's been missing for far too long, are Palestinian voices. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, the attempts to silence us, again, it doesn't serve the interests of the colonizers for us to have our stories heard, for people like my father to relate the stories of the suffering that they've endured, how they've been forced from their land, how everything's been ripped from them, and the mass slaughters, the several families and of our own members of our families that have been erased, and they don't want the stories of resistance there, because the one thing that they're infamous for is the dehumanizing and the demonizing of our resistance. Yes. In spite of us having that right under international law, yet our lives, we've been dehumanized to the point that it doesn't matter, and then the aggressor can call themselves and claim they have a right to self-defense when they do not. They are the oppressors, the occupiers. Only the occupied and the oppressed have a right to claim self-defense. And they do not want our narratives to be heard. They do not want the world to understand that we are a people who have been imprisoned and are fighting quite simply for our liberation. And it's a powerful story when people are aware of the history. It's hard to gaslight. It's hard to deflect. It's hard to alter a narrative that is fixed, that everybody is aware of. But,
Do you feel also that, you know, just the fact that a lot of stories are told about Palestinians, but most of them are told by people who are not Palestinians, like ourselves, you know, but the fact that you bring in Palestinian women like yourself, but also Nuf, you know, saying it from the ground, does it change, you think, the perspective of what the West sees a Palestinian woman is, as somebody who cannot, you know, tell her story in as powerful a manner as we are hearing?
From Nuf, nothing will be more powerful than the stories from the ground, from those that live there. And as a child of the diaspora, my stories will be different. I'm not in the ground. It's so painful watching that from afar. I'd rather be on the ground with them, and it would be far less painful than to have to watch them and not be able to act. But again, we have freedoms here that they are denied of. And it's so vital that the stories from the ground are relayed to the world so that they can see and witness for themselves, as they are now, the horrors that are inflicted upon them. And we must let their voices be heard. We must raise their voices. And for those that can't speak, we have to be those voices.
Absolutely. Now, Nof talks, you know, very painfully about the lack of support from the Arab countries, you know, how they have completely disregarded the whole of the genocide. Lubna, what has been the traditional historical relationship between Palestine and its Arab neighbors?
There is an utter betrayal, and there always has been. And it doesn't serve ultimately their capitalist interests, and this is it. It's like the sanctions by America that they'd be threatened with, the power, the stranglehold. They're afraid of another uprising like the Arab Spring, if there's revolt. They're afraid of the Arab resistance. But the thing that they must be more fearful of, and that they need to understand, is that if they don't act now, far worse is coming for all of them. Mm-hmm. It does not stop at Palestine. What is happening to Palestine, it is laying out the ground for further future injustice to occur. It is paving its way.
Yeah. I mean, for someone like me who is not Arab, you know, I find it very difficult to understand the psyche, you know, of them not seeing Palestinians as one of their own. These borders are really, you know, artificial. They are ideally the same people. How do you think this works? I mean, how do you explain this psyche that they don't see it that way? They don't see Palestinians as their own.
No, and it's and even though those countries now, I mean, there are thousands, if not millions, of Palestinians who've been forced from their homes that live in those countries. But even their voices are silenced by the government of those countries. Palestinians have not only had to fight and defend themselves from the Israeli aggressors, but also the Jordanians, who wouldn't permit them. And they're afraid. They're forced into silence. The governments do not want them to rise. They do not want them to have the power of the resistance back. Mm-hmm. Previously, and again, it's all about power, strangleholds, capitalist interests, and if they think that that's going to serve their interests, they're very, very wrong, and far worse is coming to them too.
Now, we've seen, you know, on the other side, countries like Iran, Lebanon, Yemen, you know, who may not have that close a border, except for Lebanon, of course, they have been speaking with such unwavering support and material support. I mean, they've taken a hit in their own countries. If you look at what happened to Lebanon, if you look at Iran, you know, having to face their own lives, their own countries at risk because of their pure support of Palestinians. How do Palestinians themselves see the relationship with these countries like Iran and Lebanon and Yemen?
We have a lot of love and respect for those that stand by us, and they're the ones that will also know that it does ideally serve the interest of everyone to protect each other in the region, because it doesn't stop at Palestine. The love and the protection, especially, you know, with Yemen, they've been the poorest, inflicted with such awful, grievous tragedies by the West, by America. They still stand resilient as a people. They have so much respect for Yemen and the others and the fighters in Lebanon who have stood, and it's come at a price. And they know, and Iran has obviously been attacked, and there is a test of Iran's power. It is a power play. They could have continued, and could have been a very different outcome, which I had hoped might have been the case, but we just hope that they'll all realize that it only in a unified effort will there ever be freedom and liberation for all of us, that those who don't act there, it's very grave what's coming to them.
Now, all these problems, Lubna, the whole, you know, creation of this occupation was the West, the British obviously put, you know, the occupation in place. Why is it so important for us to be in the forefront of trying to end this occupation from this very land where the problem was created?
Well, as you said, we're in the belly of the beast, you know, it began here and it should end here. We cannot be a country that talks of democracy, of liberation, of equality, when they continue with this long history of colonizing, of corruption, of killing, and the displacement of people. It's awful to think that this government will still permit it, but like we said, you know, their colonizing interests. But this must come from the ground. It's the people that have the power to stop it. The workers have the power to stop it. If the government are not going to stop it, we must.
Do you see a movement? Do you see a massive change since October 7th when it comes to people on the ground here in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, not just here, but worldwide. We've seen a worldwide movement. You know, people have become more educated since the 7th. They've realized even the mass propaganda. People are learning. They are seeing for the first time, if anything it has done, is taken this veil from people's eyes and mobilize people. I mean, people here have been marching. Their basic civil liberties are now at risk. You know, when draconian measures are taking place to prevent non-violent resistance from taking place.